This presentation will cover 1 Kings. I think we'll do this one separately from 2 Kings. One more reminder that we're not covering every book of the Bible, and we're not covering every chapter of even the books that I'm picking. And part of it's whimsical. I'm picking things I like and I find interesting. And other things we want to focus on are of interest to history and culture and literature and things like that. But don't be disappointed if I go past something you wanted to look at. The Bible's a rich treasure trove, so spend your time, enjoy some things there. We're just going to look at aspects and portions of each of these books. So we're taking a look at 1 Kings. David has taken the throne. Saul is dead. He's had a good reign until, of course, the Bathsheba trouble as he got a little older and wasn't out on the battlefield and was strolling around the king's area and saw Bathsheba, and everything fell apart from that point on. He was cursed with family troubles, and we'll see that that family fracturing is going to continue into 1 Kings. And David's a powerful leader. He's been around a long time. He's the ideal leader to the Jews as far as a combination of sensitive person, one who could write, wrote some of the Psalms, one who could compose laments for the death of Saul and Jonathan, but he was also the hard, tough fighter, warrior. He settled the area of Jerusalem, and so a lot of space is devoted to him. Of course, the promise that out of him will come the eventually the Messiah, but an everlasting kingdom. So a lot of reasons why David is pretty important. So we'll pick up in the beginning of 1 Kings, and we have struggles going on with the sons of David over who wants to be king. And there's one of David's sons, Adonijah, who is conferring with, in verse 7 of chapter 1, here's our old friend Joab showing up. And Joab, who apparently is going to outlast David, wants to figure out which way to go here, because he wants to continue in power, obviously. So Adonijah sets up a plan with Joab to try to scheme and take over the kingdom when it really was supposed to belong to Solomon. If you read 1 Chronicles 22, we see David there telling Solomon he will be the king. So let's continue. You can read about the plot and so on, but David does make Solomon officially king in second half of chapter 1. And he has an interesting section in chapter 2. I want to slow down here and have you read this with me. David now is feeling death coming over him. So he's got some of the last statements that we're going to hear from him. And I just find it interesting what he does here in chapter 2. He takes Solomon aside and he gives him a list of people. Now David has looked very kingly. He's looked very kind. He's looked above the fray, and many times, remember we talked about how he used Joab as his go-to guy, his hatchet man. And there were other times like that where David appeared kinder and more merciful than some of us might have been. But as they say, you can forgive, but don't forget. And this is what's going to happen in chapter 2. Let's pick up verse 5. David says to Solomon, "Now you know what Joab did to me." And he tells the little bit of the story of Joab. And here's Joab, who's done all the dirty work for David. But what does David say? Verse 6, "Deal with him according to your wisdom." Okay, but it's not really going to be up to Solomon. He says, "Don't let his gray head go down to the grave in peace." What is he saying? Kill him. Don't let him die a peaceful death. Don't let him die in bed surrounded by his friends and family. And then if you remember, if you go to verse 8, remember there's this character named Shimei who cursed David when David was fleeing from the revolution of Absalom. And he was pelting David and cursing at him. And some of David's strong helpers said, "Let's go take this guy out." And David said, "No, this is from the Lord. This is all part of it." So he sounded very noble. However, verse 8, chapter 2, 1 Kings, remember Shimei says, "I swore to him by the Lord, I will not put you to death by the sword." Verse 9, "But now, don't consider him innocent. You're a man of wisdom. You'll know what to do to him. Bring his gray head down to the grave in blood." So, interesting, huh? David's going to remember those two people toward the end of his life that have caused him problems, and he wants to get rid of them. One more thing that you should notice in that chapter is in verse 11. David ruled 40 years. Can you imagine that? Here in this country, we had Franklin Delano Roosevelt back in the 30s and into the 40s, who was president for, I think, 13 years into his 13th year. And people were just shocked and dismayed, and some of them were just shaken, because this president was one of the only ones they could remember. And yet, let's compare that. Can you imagine? You have had somebody over you for 40 years. So let's say you're 10, 15 years old, he takes control, takes power. You'd be established. You would have possibly grandchildren, and the only person you knew as your king was David. Talk about a time of settled conditions. And that's only going to continue for his son Solomon. And after that, there are cracks, there are earthquakes, there's chaos that's going to come to the kingdom. But talk about a settled time here for 40 years. So David dies. Solomon takes over. Important chapter in 3. He asks for wisdom. It's pretty famous. All the things that he asked for that he could have had, and he settles for wisdom. And God says, because you asked for that, you'll get more things as well. So we'll keep going, if that's all right. We're going to get the temple underway. This is so important to the Jewish people. The temple was their symbol of their spiritual connection to God. This is where God came to dwell. Remember, they've had the ark. It's been wandering around. They've brought the ark with them to Jerusalem, finally. And now it's going to have a final resting place, a more solid edifice for it. And so in chapter 6, we get the story of the building of the temple itself. And it's beautiful. It's got gold. It's got cedar. It's pure gold on the inside. Verse 20. And it's just an amazing thing. So I will skip over. It says that he took 7 years to get this thing built. So we'll skip over that. But just keep in mind the temple. Again and again, the Jewish people are going to refer to this temple. When it gets destroyed, the first thing they want to do is build another temple. And so we'll pick that up a little bit later. But I wanted you to be aware of that. So that's chapter 6. The ark is brought to the temple in chapter 8. It's dedicated. This is a tremendously important time to these people. So you can see how much space is devoted to it in 1 Kings. Let me take you to chapter 10, just to give you an idea of what Solomon was like at his zenith. My chapter 10 has a subheading called Solomon's Splendor. And one thing that critics for a while were scratching their heads over, it says the weight of the gold that Solomon received in verse 14 every year was 666 talents. You look down there, and then at least my footnote says, looking it up here, 25 tons of gold. And some people said, that's impossible. And they've since discovered other tablets in this region that describe kings getting tremendous amounts of gold. So this is a time where I guess the gold was plentiful and easy to get to. So Solomon has gold just pouring in to his kingdom at this time. Now I want you to think about what's going on historically in this entire part of the world. If you looked at your maps, you saw that little Israel sat in between two tremendous power areas. One to the west would be Egypt. One to the east would be any of the Mesopotamian powers that came along, whether it was Babylon or Sumer or Assyria eventually, and things like that. So Israel basically is just a little land bridge that gets stuck in the middle of a tremendous, powerful, strategic tug of war that goes on between these two kingdoms. If Egypt becomes strong, it shoots an army out past Israel trying to go to take care of whoever's to the east, causing them problems. And of course, when they come up to the area of Israel, it's like, which side are you going to be on? Well, you better pick whoever you think is the strongest. So you hope that you pick the right side. On the other hand, if one of the Mesopotamian powers came along and it was on the rise, it would come sweeping from the east through Israel, heading toward Egypt to clash there. And again, the question was, which side are you on? So these people had to be very, very careful. Well, not in the time of Solomon. Solomon comes along at a time when both Egypt and any of the powers of Mesopotamia were pretty weak. And he has a chance to solidify this kingdom, to make it powerful. He's sitting right on a trade route. Perfect location. He can tax these caravans that come and go as they barter and trade between Egypt and Mesopotamia and other places to the north. So it's a trade kingdom, especially. That's what some people think was going on when the Queen of Sheba, also mentioned in chapter 10, was visiting Solomon. This may have been a trade agreement. So anyway, so I just wanted you to think about the power and the wealth of this time. Go down, I'm still in chapter 10 of 1 Kings, go down to verse 21. He's drinking out of golden goblets. It says, nothing was made of silver. Silver was considered of little value. Phew, why mess with silver, right? That's cheesy stuff. Make mine gold. Further on down there, well, verse 23, greater in riches and wisdom than all the other kings of the earth. Now, it's hard to say if that's hyperbole, but the point is he's doing very, very well. Verse 26, he accumulated chariots and horses. According to this, he had 1,400 chariots, 12,000 horses, and they found some of his stables that were just immense. So there's probably truth to this. He was becoming a huge power. But all good things have to come to an end. If we move to the beginning, well, the end of chapter 11, beginning of chapter 12, we've got somebody who named Jeroboam who's rebelled against Solomon. And Jeroboam was able to flee for a while for safety to Egypt. And Solomon finally dies at the end of chapter 11. He has a son, Rehoboam. Okay, it's too bad they're so close in sounds, but then we have Rehoboam who comes to power. And so he wants to know how to rule and how to handle things after his father is dead. And remember what, long, long time ago, what Samuel had said to the people, do you really want a king? Keep in mind what that means. If you get a king, you get all sorts of taxes, you get all sorts of impositions, you have drafts, you're in trouble. If you want a king, he's going to demand a lot of you. And so that's what's been happening under Solomon. He has been taxing the people pretty heavily. So the people come to Jeroboam. He's their new king. And they say in chapter 12, near the beginning, verse 4, your father put a heavy yoke on us. Would you please lighten the harsh labor and the heavy yoke, and we will serve you. Well, Rehoboam is pretty fresh, pretty new, kind of green. He goes to his advisors, and they say, oh, no, you got to be hard on these people. You give them an inch, they'll take a mile. So he goes back and he says, oh no, I'm going to be tougher on you than ever. And the people said, really? And that was it. And we get this huge rebellion. And Israel, the northern part, rebelled against the southern part. Remember, that's where David is from, the southern part, Judah. So Judah stays with the king, Rehoboam, but the northern part splits in rebellion and sides with Jeroboam. And Jeroboam sets up a capital to the north and Samaria, that area, and basically sets up a whole separate kingdom and sets up false idols and things like that. So this is not just two guys that disagree, but it's two different cultures are beginning to form here. Let's continue past that. We have kings coming along. We get a little story of the lines of kings from both the southern area, that'd be Judah, and the northern area, Israel. By the way, it's very confusing, isn't it? We used to describe Israel as the entire land of the Jews. Now, when we say Israel, the king of Israel, as opposed to the king of Judah, the king of Israel will be the northern king, the roughly 10 tribes that stayed with Jeroboam. So Rehoboam will be setting up the land of Judah. So we got Judah in the south, we got Israel in the north. So we get a list of some of these kings that came in. And one who comes in is Ahab. And Ahab is given a lot of time. And he's mentioned, first of all, at the end of chapter 16. And what's interesting is that he ruled in Samaria, right, that's up in the north, over Israel 22 years. And yet all we get here are the bad things that he did. So I want you to think a little bit for just a minute as far as what we think of as history today versus what they thought of as history back then, as far as biblical history goes. they were not as concerned with the politics, the economic history, the sociological history, the literary history. For them, when you read the history here in Kings, you're getting religious history in a sense. You're looking at all of history from the perspective or the viewpoint of religious fervor. In other words, who stayed closest to the God of Israel? Those are called good kings. How about the ones that strayed from the God of Israel? They're considered bad kings. So Ahab ruled 22 years. Now, you figure 22 years, he must have done some things well. He may have done well in the battlefield. He may have brought some good reforms to the land. But all we get here are negative stories because he has strayed from God. And that's the point of him, that he's an illustration of what not to do. So here comes Ahab. We're going to meet Elijah, but hold that thought. We're going to come back to Elijah later on. If that's all right, we get some stories about him. But I want to talk about him as a prophet, and we'll see that actually more in 2 Kings. So let's skip over that for now, especially the famous story of him with the prophets of Baal up on Mount Carmel. So let's continue on in chapter 21. We get one of the stories of Ahab doing some terrible things, basically taking land from somebody else. He wasn't supposed to do that. The king had to obey the same laws as the people did, but they basically steal land thanks to not only Ahab, but his wife Jezebel. Of course, you've heard of Jezebel. Becomes almost a symbol of evil incarnate here. So the two of them work a way to seize this guy's property, a man named Naboth. So that just gives you an illustration of what this man is like. Chapter 22, Ahab is surrounded with yes men, and he's going to go to war. And all these men around him say, "Great idea, King. Oh, we're with you, King." But the king knows there's one man. And there's another individual that's not there that Ahab says, "I think you ought to bring him in. His name is Micaiah. And bring him in because he always says the truth." So he knows these guys are just kissing up to him. And so verse 13 of chapter 22, the messenger who's bringing Micaiah to the king takes him aside and says, "Hey, look. As one man, the other prophets are predicting success for the king. Let your word agree with theirs and speak favorably." But Micaiah says, "I only tell them what the Lord tells me." Look at that line one more time. Verse 14 of chapter 22. I can tell him only what the Lord tells me. That's the story of prophets, which we will discuss later. But that's all a prophet was doing, is to speak the words of God to the people. "Thus saith the Lord." And then they would tell him. So he shows up, and the king says to him in verse 15, "Micaiah, should we go to war?" And he says, "Attack and be victorious, for the Lord will give it into the king's hand." Well, that should have made Ahab happy, because he's agreeing with all the other prophets. Now, in verse 16, we pick up a clue here that Micaiah did not say it the way I just said it. Look what 16 says. The king talks to Micaiah, "How many times must I make you swear to tell me nothing but the truth in the name of the Lord?" So there was something in the way Micaiah talked that let Ahab know he was being mocked. And so he says to Micaiah, "No, this time tell me the truth." And Micaiah does. He tells him, "It's going to be awful. You're going to die. It's going to be a terrible battle and a big loss." So you can decide, be imaginative here, but how did he say, "Attack and be victorious, for the Lord will give it into the king's hand"? I picture it maybe overly dramatic, maybe sweeping hand gestures and "attack and be victorious, for the Lord will give it into the king's hand." And Micaiah rolling his eyes maybe, I don't know. But Ahab caught on immediately. He said, "No, tell me the truth." Verse 18, after he hears the truth, the king sounds kind of whiny here. He says, "Didn't I tell you he never prophesies anything good about me, but only bad?" So he's saying, "I knew it. I knew he was going to say bad stuff." Well, the end of 1 Kings ends with this battle. Ahab is killed. He dies. And so that's just one more disaster for the people here. But I hope you can see what's going on here. We get this split in the kingdom. And basically we're heading for a terrible, terrible fall for both halves of the kingdom. And what we'll pick up in 2 Kings is Israel and then Judah crashing and burning as nations rise in strength and come in with terrible vindictiveness and terrible power. And we'll get some psychological warfare. We'll talk about the lost tribes of Israel. And we'll spend a little more time seeing the end result of this split in the kingdom.